Welcome back to VOA Asia Weekend. From Washington, D.C., I'm Ari Arifin, in for Ira Melman and Jim Stevenson, with a look back to the past week of news and feature stories that made up our daily VOA Asia program. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Russian President Vladimir Putin vowed they would work toward closer ties at their summit in the far eastern Russian city of Vladivostok. But the meeting is not likely to have much effect on Kim's deadlocked nuclear talks with the United States, as Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Kim Jong-un went to Russia with one big request: relief from sanctions that are punishing his economy. But it's not clear if Vladimir Putin gave him what he wants. There were a lot of opportunities for pictures, but few details emerged from the discussion, and both men mostly stuck to talking points.
Russia is ready to continue cooperation to de-escalate tensions on the Korean Peninsula and strengthen the security of the whole of Northeast Asia.
I am proposing a toast to happiness and the beautiful future of our two countries' people.
Afterwards, Putin said he is open to discussing a pipeline or railways through North Korea, but appeared to offer Kim no relief from sanctions, which Putin himself helped put in place.
Putin has to be pretty careful because publicly he can't really go back on the commitment Russia made in 2017 to those UN sanctions.
Putin also raised the possibility of a return to six-party talks on North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Those multilateral discussions broke down more than a decade ago.
From the American point of view, I would say pretty confidently this is a non-starter.
Kim seems to have left the summit in much the way he came in, searching for economic help with few places left to turn. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
This past week, China hosted leaders from 37 countries for its Belt and Road Initiative, a massive development program expected to involve more than $1 trillion for infrastructure projects. The United States warns countries that the projects are primarily aimed at boosting China's economy, and the financial terms carry risks to countries' economies. VOA's Jesusime Oni has more.
A parade of leaders arrive in Beijing for a summit showcasing China's growing influence. They have traveled from all over the world because China is offering high-speed train links, modern ports, and new highways.
In Africa, South America, Middle East, and some European countries, they see it's a great opportunity because the Belt and Road Initiative primarily emphasizes infrastructure development, which is also made China become successful at the first place in terms of economic development.
However, the U.S. says countries could end up with a bad deal, accusing Beijing of trying to lure nations into a debt trap. The Belt and Road Initiative has funded trains, roads, and ports in several developing nations. It has also left some struggling to repay the Chinese loans, further fueling concerns about the program's high cost and lack of transparency.
Some of the recipient countries are worried that the funding is actually helping Chinese companies more than their own companies. Maybe in some cases it's encouraging corruption or damaging the environment. And so we're starting to see a bit of pushback.
China this year is adjusting its approach, reducing the cost of some projects, pledging environmental safeguards, and offering to collaborate with partners such as Japan.
In this regard, I don't think there's such a problem, and BRI can only bring them a great deal of help and bring about development.
The BRI, which aims to link Asia to Europe and Africa, continues to gain momentum. Despite warnings from the West, Italy recently became the first European nation to join the program, signing on with deals worth 2.5 million euros. With Switzerland now following suit, Beijing hopes to attract even more. Jason Semeoni, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for tuning in to VOA Asia Weekend. Myanmar's de facto leader and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi is welcoming businesses to invest in the Rakhine State, more than a year and a half since a brutal military crackdown forced hundreds of thousands of minority Rohingya Muslims to flee into neighboring Bangladesh. Despite the push for investment, many residents in Rakhine State worry they will not see any of the benefits. Libby Hogan has this report from Rakhine State.
A zone without hatred declares this sign in Chukpu Beach in Rakhine State, Western Myanmar. But this quiet beach is in the southern part of the same state where in the north, the military launched a brutal crackdown against the minority Rohingya Muslims beginning in August 2017, forcing more than 700,000 to flee. Now, big business is being welcomed to this coastal region by Aung San Suu Kyi, the de facto leader in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. She recently urged Chinese and Japanese business leaders to invest in Rakhine's oil and gas fields, downplaying troubles in the state.
For too long, the international community's attention has been focused narrowly on negative aspects related to problems in North Rakhine, rather than on the panoramic picture that shows the immense potential of this state for peace and prosperity.
But the crisis in Rakhine seems far from over. Journalists and investigators are not allowed into the same state to investigate reports of human rights abuses against the minority Muslim Rohingya. Many who fled still live in crowded camps in Bangladesh. The Rakhine villages where they lived have been bulldozed and Burmese contractors have been hired to build processing sites for those who want to return. In Rakhine's Sitwe region, more than 120,000 Rohingya Muslims have lived in camps surrounded by wire fencing for 7 years. South in Chukpu, the land is mostly owned by ethnic Rakhine. They say they've been shut out of talks about investment projects. And they complain they've seen few benefits from billion-dollar investments, such as this joint venture Chinese and Myanmar oil and gas pipeline, part of its One Road, One Belt initiative.
When the project began, local people got only small jobs like selling rocks and carrying sand at the construction sites. But for the skilled jobs, our local people were not hired. Locals cannot get any long-term benefits from the project.
A watchdog group monitoring China's pipeline projects says farmers still haven't been paid for land taken years ago.
There was no transparency about compensation when villagers' land was confiscated, so villagers do not know if they will get the same amount that is written on paper.
Rakhine farmer La Thane says he was paid for the grazing land where the pipeline was built, but not for all the crops ruined during its construction.
Farmers feel angry because now they can't grow crops on their farmland because of the mud.
With billions of dollars in gas and oil underground, people in this troubled province are likely headed for more upheaval in the years to come if they continue to see no benefits from investment. Libby Hogan for VOA News, Chukpu Beach, Myanmar.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. President Donald Trump this week proposed new measures to crack down on people who travel to the United States on a visa and then illegally remaining in the country after their visa expires. The new policy will punish countries with high rates of visa overstays and will mostly impact African nations. White House correspondent Patsy Widakuswara reports.
In 2018, the United States issued more than 9 million non-immigrant visas for visitors, including tourists, students and temporary workers from all over the world. About 2% remain longer than allowed in the country. The White House has ordered the Secretaries of State and Homeland Security to identify ways to reduce non-immigrant visa overstays within 3 months. Countries that do not reduce their high overstay rates could be penalized with tougher U.S. visa requirements. The policy is seen as an extension of Trump's push to reduce illegal immigration beyond unauthorized border crossings.
Congress must also act to fix, however, our horrible, obsolete, weak, pathetic immigration laws.
Under the plan, some countries could see tightened visa restrictions or even requirements that travelers pay admission bonds, which would be refunded when they leave. Government data show that in recent years, non-immigrant visa overstays exceed the number of border apprehensions, making up a significant portion of the approximately 11 million people living in the U.S. illegally. But some analysts question the administration's strategy of targeting countries with high overstay rates rather than countries with a high number of overstaying individuals.
Chad has an overstay rate or a suspected overstay rate about 20%, but that only translates to about 140 people in 2017, whereas you have a country like the United Kingdom, which has more than 23,000 overstays suspected in 2017. So although the rate for the United Kingdom is very low, the numbers, 23,000, is much more than 140.
Djibouti, Solomon Islands, Eritrea, Chad, Liberia, and Somalia are among those with the highest overstay rates. It's unclear what steps the countries could take to convince travelers to return home. The administration has not responded to VOA questions about the motivations behind focusing on overstay rates, but immigration activists say the move unfairly targets African countries and could be challenged in the courts.
If the government decided that they were going to limit B1, B2 tourist business visas to people from African nations, you could bring a claim based on discrimination and say that this rule change or this administrative change is arbitrary and actually based in discrimination.
Analysts point out there may be another reason why the administration is focusing on countries with high overstay rates.
These countries are smaller countries, and that the administration may feel that it's easier to deal with them than trying to tackle a large country in which we have a lot of interactions with, like Canada or Mexico or the United Kingdom.
Canada, Mexico, and the United Kingdom are countries with the top five highest number of total overstays, as well as Brazil and Venezuela. The Trump administration says it considers tackling visa overstays a priority to protect American taxpayers. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Coming up, social media is forced to address social issues. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend.
The Voice of America.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Social media companies such as Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook are not legally responsible for the content that users upload to their sites. That legal protection has been key to their explosive growth. But there is a growing consensus that companies must do more to root out misleading content. Michelle Quinn reports the companies may be taking action in the hope of avoiding stricter government regulation.
It began like so many other falsehoods on social media. As the Notre Dame Cathedral burned in Paris, fake news and conspiracy theories started to crop up on Twitter, jump to Facebook, and percolated on YouTube. This time, however, none of them really went viral.
I think tech platforms would point to the things they're trying to do to limit the spread of misinformation as saying, hey, this is proof that what we're doing is working. Honestly, like from where I sit, I think it's really just like more people are aware that this is happening, so people are less likely to share something like right out the bat.
People are also expecting action from the companies. Facebook is collaborating with fact checkers to weed out objectionable content. Twitter has targeted bots, automatic accounts that spread falsehoods. YouTube is trying to alter its algorithm to make it harder to find problematic videos. Some say it's not enough.
What have you done to ensure that all your folks out there globally know the dog whistles and know the key words, the phrasing, you know, the things that people respond to ensure that we can stop some of this and be more proactive in blocking some of this language?
We do have 30,000 people now focused on safety and security. And within that 30,000 people, we have specific subject matter experts that focus on this area. So we have academics, we have other people who come from civil society, human rights backgrounds, to really dive deep in this area. We do use a lot of our automation and artificial intelligence to help provide the data analysis.
Well, I hope you do more. Thank you.
Right now, there's a lot of outsourcing going on. In other words, washing our own hands of the problem rather than saying, this is a mess we've created and we are going to devote resources that will lower the profits to shareholders because it will require a deeper investment in our own company. And that, at a massive level, is not what's going on.
For now, human fact checkers are using technology to monitor the sites and flag objectionable content.
They are then able to create a database now of bad actors, and they can start taking action against them, which will reduce the impressions, reduce their financial incentive, because they'll get less clicks and they'll get less advertising.
While reducing impressions slows the spread of misinformation, it also slows Facebook's growth. Does being more responsible mean making less money? Social media companies are trying to find that out. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Mountains are not just above the ground where we can see. As scientists have found, mountains exist deep in the earth. VOA's Rick Pantilio takes a moment to explain.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists found evidence that the topography of the mantle transition zone, a layer of Earth's composition that lies between the upper and lower mantle layers, is similar to mountains that can be found on the surface. The international group of researchers studied data from a powerful earthquake in Bolivia and discovered there are mountains and other topographical features located about 660 kilometers straight below our feet. They added that many areas of the mantle transition zone are rougher in nature and that a number of these subterranean mountains may be bigger than what can be found on Earth's surface. Writing in a recent edition of the journal Science, the scientists say they made their findings after analyzing seismic wave data produced by a Category 8.2 earthquake that rocked the South American country in 1994. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Avengers Endgame marks the culmination of Marvel's superhero universe since its first Iron Man film in 2008. Critics have hailed the three-hour movie as a super spectacle and a befitting ending, harkening back to the beginnings of the Avengers franchise. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with critics and industry insiders about the significance of the film, about its franchise, and the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
After a cliffhanger ending of Avengers Infinity War, where the galactic overlord Thanos reduces half of Earth's planet life to dust, the second installment, Avengers Endgame, is the final chapter of the Avengers franchise, bringing together all the superheroes of the Marvel Universe in a final battle against the omnipotent Titan. Washington Post comic book culture reporter David Betancourt says the film is expected to be the blockbuster of all blockbusters.
Endgame is the final chapter of something we've never seen before, which is a connected narrative through multiple film franchises over the course of a decade. This will be the 22nd Marvel Studios film.
But what elements create a blockbuster of such magnitude? Above all, according to Paul Rudd, who plays Ant-Man, it is the characters.
These characters are archetypes. And the emotional resonance, the relationships they have with one another, and it's really the main thing that makes the movies work.
Then there's the storyline, says Thor actor Chris Hemsworth.
I think it's the darkest in some ways. The sort of wackiest, in other words. It feels like there's a real sort of drama at the core of it, you know, a sort of small indie character-driven sort of drama on one hand, and then coupled with it being the most expensive, biggest, visually stunning, smorgasbord effects-driven film you could ever imagine.
A blockbuster could not be without an unexpected ending, says Avengers pioneer Iron Man actor Robert Downey Jr.
The last 8 minutes of that movie are maybe the best 8 minutes in the entire history of the whole run of them, in a way, you know, because everyone's involved.
Plot and characters aside, a blockbuster is about money, says Hollywood insider Stephen Paterno.
Disney, with the Marvel Universe and the Star Wars Universe, are, and never mind Pixar and all their family-friendly animations there, clearly have a blockbuster factory. And so, yes, that is generating billions, if not 10 plus billion dollars in theatrical revenue, but then it drives television and theme parks and action figures and the rest.
Movie theaters across the country offered marathon screenings of all 22 Marvel Cinematic Universe movies leading up to the premiere of Avengers Endgame.
Endgame, just based off of the pre-sales and the hype, it wouldn't surprise me if it inched towards $3 billion.
Dollars, that is. The end of the Avengers franchise also signals a new phase of Marvel Universe featuring a more ethnically diverse superhero universe, says Betancourt.
You have Black Panther, it made $1 billion. You have Captain Marvel, it made $1 million. Marvel Studios is now in pre-production on an all-Asian ensemble for an Asian superhero that they have in their ranks. They've proven that there's an audience for those type of heroes. Not only an audience, but that the same audience you were treating with those initial Avengers movies wants to see those type of movies as well.
Hey, Miss Potts. If you find this recording, don't feel bad about this. Part of the journey is the end.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
The Voice of America.
VOA Asia Weekend continues with an update on the situation in Sri Lanka after the explosions that took place on Easter Sunday. Jim Stevenson has more.
Sri Lanka, still reeling from the impact of the deadly Easter Sunday explosions, has banned women from wearing face veils. The president implemented the ban under an emergency law. The ban went into effect Monday. Officials said the move will help security forces with the identification process as the country continues to search for the people responsible for the Easter Sunday explosions that targeted churches and hotels. In another development, Sri Lankan local media report that police have identified the woman and the girl who were pulled Saturday from rubble of a shootout between security forces and militants that killed 15 people, including 6 children. Officials say the pair are the wife and daughter of Zahran Hashim, the suspected mastermind behind the deadly attacks on churches and hotels that killed more than 250 people. Sri Lankan media released surveillance camera footage showing an alleged bomber checking into Kingsbury Hotel in the capital Colombo and his movements just before the bomb went off. Authorities have said that attacks, most of which in Colombo, were carried out by 9 individuals, 8 of whom are already identified. VOA Asia's Ira Melman got in touch with Elena Teplitz, the U.S. ambassador to Sri Lanka in Colombo. As we will hear, they discussed a wide range of topics.
A few days ago, you and others said there were still elements of terrorist organizations in Sri Lanka. You said they were all armed and ready to go and they could do harm to the people of the country. Is that still the case?
Well, our travel advisory indicates what we know, and that is that we still believe there are terrorists actively plotting. I think the good news is that there has been a lot of progress in the investigation. The Sri Lankan authorities have been successful in apprehending suspects and finding safe houses. These are obviously very positive developments with regard to the immediate safety and security in the people and the people of the island. I think the challenge when you're looking at a situation like this is that a lot of coordination has to happen to disrupt these active plots. And then there's a lot of work that's going to have to go on behind the scenes going forward. Coordination between intelligence and law enforcement, focus by the government on this global terror threat. So there's always going to be a need to be vigilant. And I think even after the active plot is wrapped up, the government, foreign partners, everybody's going to have to remain focused on this as a potential threat.
What has the United States done so far as reaction to the attacks that have taken place, and what further can this country do?
The United States has done a couple of things. First is we surged support to the government of Sri Lanka to help with the investigation and then apprehension of the active plotters. We have an FBI team here on the ground working hand in glove in a joint investigation with the Sri Lankan authorities. We also have been very vigilant about warning American citizens. We take seriously our obligation to protect our public and want to make sure that they have the best information possible so that they can make the best decisions about their environment. You might have noticed that our travel advisory has been upgraded twice since this event occurred, and that we are poised, of course, as new information comes in, to share with the public any threat that we might perceive is there. We also, as part of this, have been helping American citizens who were victims of this attack. So many Sri Lankans, so many families impacted by this, many others from the foreign community. But of course, there were four Americans who lost their lives, four more who were injured in this, and we did our best to support them in an hour of need.
So the Sri Lankan government, with all of its recent problems, is working well with you in helping to solve the problems. Is that correct?
That's right. We have a good cooperation, and they had welcomed the help.
There's a new development that Muslims in Sri Lanka will no longer be able to veil their faces. That under an emergency law ordered by President Sirisena. It bans all kinds of face coverings, so they say they can see people's identities. Do you have any reaction to that?
Well, the government is looking, I think, at a number of emergency measures. They certainly wanted to be able to respond promptly in the wake of this attack. We have been following their efforts in this regard and encouraging them, as President Sirisena himself said, to ensure that these measures are very focused and limited to the scope of this particular incident. Going forward, the country had been working on revisions of its terrorism laws, has been looking at other reform measures, and we encourage them to continue to head in that direction. The government has committed to addressing some of the poor human rights practices of the past. We've been encouraging them to reform their processes and approaches for the future. I think this is even more reason why that needs to be done, because respecting people's democratic rights, respecting the rights of communities, is something that can coexist in a democratic society with efforts to combat global terrorism. The Sri Lankans can make very good choices about how to approach that. And the president's indication that these emergency powers would only be used to focus on the perpetrators of this terrible crime, I think, is an important acknowledgement of that.
What about the division between the Sri Lankan president and the country's prime minister? Is that still causing problems as far as politics and programs advancing in that country?
Well, you're aware of the constitutional crisis that the country was immersed in at the end of last year. That crisis was resolved. And the president and prime minister have been focused more intently on the needs of the nation. We certainly encourage them to stay focused on what needs to be done to ensure Sri Lanka's security and its prosperity going forward. Clearly, united leadership is going to contribute to security and prosperity. So that's something that I think everyone's got to be mindful of. Everybody needs to rise above the politics to a certain degree.
How did you feel when this attack occurred? Here you are in a beautiful country, you have many things to do. What went through your mind when you heard that this had happened?
Well, the first thing that went through my mind with this, that this happened is, what can we do to help? We have obligations on a number of levels, and it's a responsibility that we're certainly very proud to carry out, even while we're terribly saddened by the circumstances that we sometimes have to engage in. So our first task actually was to find out who might have been caught up in this terrible event. We had teams out searching the hospitals and the morgues to find American citizens who might have been killed or injured in this, to make sure that we could support their families. And then we were simultaneously engaging with our hosts here, with the Sri Lankan government, to see what we could do to assist and bring our resources to bear. When something, a tragedy of this kind, strikes, such a senseless attack, our first impulse is to see what we can do to help everybody who's been impacted.
Any other issues that you feel we should discuss?
Well, obviously, we have been very focused also on expressing our support and sympathy for the families and of the victims in a very direct way, of course, supporting the American families. But more broadly, this was such a terrible and despicable act, and the people who were victims of it certainly did not deserve this, nor did the country here. And we're want to renew our commitment to pursuing terrorist groups and to pursuing them on a global level, not just here in Sri Lanka. I think that is a challenge that all nations are ready to face and need to dig in order to ensure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Elena Teplitz, the U.S. ambassador to Sri Lanka. Indonesia has released North Korean coal seized a year ago in an apparent violation of UN sanctions, posing a challenge to ongoing U.S.-led international efforts to crack down on North Korea's sanctions evasion, according to the latest report by UN sanctions monitors and court documents. The North Korean vessel Wise Honest was detained by Indonesian authorities in April 2018 when it entered Indonesian territorial waters without turning on the ship's identification transponder or notifying the ship's destined port authority to obtain ship clearance, according to a report issued by the United Nations Security Council in March. According to court documents that VOA Korean Service obtained, an Indonesian district court last November allowed the coal to be transferred to another ship owned by a Vietnamese company. Malaysian authorities then stopped that vessel. Joshua Stanton, a Washington-based attorney who helped draft the North Korean Sanctions Enforcement Act in 2016, thinks Indonesia should have seized the coal.
If the ship is involved in smuggling, the coal has to be seized. That's an obligation. They should not have released the coal. The coal should have been seized and not returned.
Stanton said the United States has legal authority to punish the ports that do not fully comply with their obligations to inspect the cargo of a ship that floats from port to port with its transponders switched off. He says North Korea also often registers its ships through shell companies and front companies operating in Hong Kong, and adds that the Hong Kong authorities have been completely lax in any kind of due diligence to verify that the companies they're registering have a legitimate business purpose. A U.S. official told VOA's Korean service that the United States is aware of this case. We thank VOA Indonesian reporters for contributing to this report, which originated in VOA Korean.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. Chinese President Xi Jinping says people in China want bluer skies, greener mountains, and clearer water in his address Sunday at the opening ceremony for the 2019 Beijing International Horticultural Expo. Xi said the country has embarked on the construction of ecological civilization. China is the world's worst polluter, but has made efforts to cut down on carbon emissions in the past decade. VOA's Zlatika Hoke reports the Asian country is using the international gathering to demonstrate its commitment to global ecological development.
The expo is held at a 500-hectare site at the foot of the Great Wall in Beijing's Jiangqing district and will last until October 7th. More than 16 million visitors are expected to attend 2,500 activities and exhibits by more than 80 countries and 24 international organizations. A Chinese sound effect designer helped create an opening show highlighting the beauty of nature around the world.
We extracted some real sounds from nature, birds, insects, water, and so on. We want to create an immersive feeling for the audience. For the music, we intended to highlight the theme of horticulture, and we combined some classical pieces from home and abroad with our own original music. We want the people to be able to sense the beauty and our love for horticulture.
Addressing an international audience Sunday evening, President Xi Jinping called for the pursuit of harmony between man and nature.
We should maintain an overall balance in the ecological environment of the earth so as to let our offspring enjoy abundant material wealth while being able to see a starry sky and lush mountains and smell the fragrance of flowers.
The Chinese leader said both society and economy can benefit from ecological development.
A sound ecology itself contains infinite economic value, which can continuously create comprehensive benefits and realize sustainable social and economic development.
China produces more carbon emissions than any other country in the world, due mostly to its use of coal for energy. With pollution becoming a leading health hazard, the government has begun introducing measures to improve the environment. President Xi has promoted the idea of making environmental awareness the mainstream culture of the Chinese society. Vicente Los Sertales, Secretary General of Paris-based Bureau International des Expositions, says much remains to be done, but he commended the Chinese government for concrete efforts such as reforestation and reducing coal consumption.
I've been doing works about China for 30 years, and I've witnessed China's achievements in these years, and the holding of each exposition has bettered not only the city, but also the people's thoughts.
He also praised Chinese people for their active cooperation in public and private ecological programs. Zlatica Ho, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. Office buildings require a lot of maintenance, and much of that work needs to be done outside the building. There are windows to clean and potential structure problems to identify. The work, which calls for scaffolding built from the ground or a platform suspended from the roof, is dangerous and expensive. But soon drones may be doing all that work for us. VOA's Kevin Enox gets our report off the ground.
Instead of scaffolding around big buildings, imagine a swarm of drones, methodically doing all kinds of chores, from cleaning windows to looking for problems and performing simple maintenance. Researchers from England and Switzerland have programmed these drones to do just that by adding a simple anchor and tether.
So it places this anchor and then pulls back to tighten the string, and then uses an admittance controller to lower itself down to perch in a completely vertical position. By doing then this mobility, elongating the string, it can move up and down and like this assess, repair, and sense or sample the surface.
But these researchers are looking way past buildings, and they see a world where drones are crawling across all kinds of giant structures, from tunnels to subways to mines.
The drones would routinely monitor the structures, and once they identify any abnormality or any potential damage, they would go closer, perch the structure, do the inspection tasks, and if needed, they would even send repair agents that would go there and do the repair tasks.
Not only are these drones able to continuously monitor big structures, but having them around means conducting routine assessment and maintenance won't have to be a costly production.
For example, today there is the tendency to build scaffolding or to use helicopters to do various assessment tasks. And really the question is, how can we provide robotic systems that would do a lot of those tasks much faster, in a much more adaptive, much more reactive way?
As always, the fear is that robots will take away human jobs, but these researchers say drones are just another tool, not a replacement for people.
Drones still have negative connotations in some discussions, but I think it is important that we show how they can support normal workflows, how they can support humans in their day-to-day jobs to make their life easier, less dangerous, while at the same time reducing cost of operation.
The research team took their inspiration from the natural world, watching how spiders move up and down their webs. Kevin Enox, VOA News.
The Voice of America.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, do you sometimes feel as if the world is getting larger? Well, apparently the universe is as we hear. VOA's Rick Pantilio takes a moment to explain.
This is Science in a Minute.
A few years ago, a trio of physicists won Nobel Prizes for their work that shows the universe is expanding at a rapid rate. New research led by Adam Riess, one of the three Nobel laureates at Johns Hopkins University, has confirmed that the universe is not only rapidly expanding, but is doing so at a rate 9% faster than expected. Riess's researchers say that they use new measurements taken by NASA's Hubble Space Telescope and base the jump in speed of the expansion on a trajectory that was seen shortly after the Big Bang nearly 14 billion years ago. The way scientists usually take their star measurements takes a lot of time. But using a new measurement method called DASH, the researchers were able to use the Hubble as you would with a point-and-shoot camera that many of us use today. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The saying, don't judge a book by its cover, means you shouldn't prejudge the value of something by its outward appearance. At a college near Washington, D.C., some people became human books, of sorts, as they discussed how appearances can be deceiving and cause preconceived biases. As we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, some of them talked about their struggles and achievements, despite difficult circumstances.
Instead of checking out a book in their library, students at Northern Virginia Community College in Alexandria, Virginia, could check out a person, a human book.
expression.
Patricia Cooper describes this event called the Human Library.
The goal of the Human Library is to talk to people in your community who you may otherwise not speak to because you have your own prejudices or your own stigma, and hopefully to break down some of these barriers.
College official Najib Baha knows what it is like to try to break down barriers. Because he has fair skin and an Arabic name, people are often surprised to learn he is from Afghanistan. He says he has been detained in airports by security because he does not look like what people perceive as the typical Afghan.
My goal is to inform everybody the things that I've gone through and to focus on not just their somebody's skin color or their name. Just, oh, we shouldn't judge people because they have a certain last name or they speak a language with an accent.
Student Angel Navia was enlightened by the conversation.
The struggles that just come from something simple, just the name or where you're from, and how that dictates some aspects of your life.
Student advisor Connie Robinson was another human book, sharing how she survived domestic abuse.
Life is 10% what happens to us and 90% how we deal with it.
Colleges around the world also host discussions like this as part of the Human Library Project, an international movement that challenges stereotypes and prejudices through dialogue. Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
VOA Asia Weekend continues with a story on the Japanese emperor. Jim Stevenson has more.
Japanese Emperor Akihito announced his abdication at a palace ceremony Tuesday in his final address as the nation embraced the end of his reign with reminiscence and hope for a new era. As he walked out of the room following his speech, Akihito turned around, paused, and bowed to the audience. His reign ran through midnight when his son, Crown Prince Norihito, who observed Akihito's abdication ceremony, became the new emperor and his era began. Akihito's reign is being seen by many as one where the Japanese population approved of what he was doing. Recent media surveys have shown public support for the imperial family at 80%. That's the highest ever for the institution. Annika Culver, associate professor of East Asian history at Florida State University, further explained to VOA Asia's Ira Melman how Akihito drew that approval.
I wouldn't exactly call him a people's emperor, but he just seems to have a kind of personality that he has this open curiosity about the people he meet. And also, if you trace him from his kind of early years when he was groomed for the imperial position as a child and then a teenager, much of his young adulthood was under the auspices of the U.S. occupation through his Quaker tutor, Elizabeth Vining. So he came into contact with Americans, a variety of people that previous emperors never had contact with. He also endeared himself to the Japanese public by jogging around the Imperial Palace, and it became kind of a ritual to see if you could see him. And this was maybe about 15, 20 years back or so, where he could be seen doing a circuit around the Imperial Palace. I'm not exactly sure the distance, if it's an exact 5K or not, but you know, just the fact that he seemed accessible. Of course, the Imperial Household Agency does a lot of curating of his appearances, and they do a lot of handling. But he generally gives the impression that he's not removed from the people. He just has this kind of happy-go-lucky personality that endears him to other people, and I think that he's had to, right, because of the dark image, especially in terms of the mind of Japan's Asian neighbors, of Emperor Hirohito as being this distant figure perched atop a white horse in a military uniform. That's kind of the iconic image that you have of the Showa Emperor, whereas Akihito, you see him smiling and waving his hand, and that's one of the photos that kind of hits strikes me as communicating that new vision.
What has led to this abdication?
I think it's a really smart move on behalf of Emperor Akihito that he steps down at a time when he's aging. He's in his early 80s. For him to pass down power to his son who kind of gives this image of a youthful Japan, right? Instead of an aging population, we have a hearty and hale Crown Prince Naruhito, now becoming Emperor Naruhito, at a time when Japan is dealing with these issues of aging, and also how to kind of reposition itself in the world instead of Japan passing, Japan having kind of this active role in global endeavors that still kind of communicate peace, the spreading of peace, rather than a more kind of militaristic image, which some of Japan's Asian neighbors have been concerned with Abe's initiatives, possible revision of the Constitution, more like reinterpretation to many different degrees. And so Emperor Naruhito's goal, I think, as a not a person with political power, but with important symbolic power, is to show Japan as a responsible global power with the ability to kind of proactively contribute to peace.
Many things you have said about the imperial family reminds me of the British royal family.
Yes, very much so.
And is the Japanese imperial family as loved as the British royal family is?
Well, you know, the Brits have their tabloids, and I'm not sure if, well, loved or just interested in. You know, it's fascinating. Like, if you go to Japan, they also have their own tabloids. And, of course, with the imperial family in Japan, there's a little bit more respect than British tabloids extend to, you know, their targets, right? And I think it's still kind of part of this mystique of the imperial institution, which harkens back to pre-war and wartime times. Older generations have a huge amount of respect for the imperial institution and the imperial family. I think younger people are more, you know, interested in them as people instead of symbols of an institution. But I just think, yeah, they're interesting parallels, but I think also the connections with England are quite important because of the kind of traditional education of the aristocracy in England.
Naruhito will formally ascend the chrysanthemum throne on Wednesday. His wife Masako and daughter Aiko were barred from the ceremony because they are female members of the royal family, a palace tradition that the government upheld despite criticism that it is out of step with modern values.
Thanks for tuning in to VOA Asia Weekend. As U.S. farmers prepare for planting this year, they do so under a cloud of uncertainty created by continuing tariffs on U.S. grain exports. They also aren't buying new equipment, which VOA's Kane Faribault reports is a growing concern for manufacturers who not only see declining sales, but increasing costs for the material they need to create their products.
Their iconic blue-colored equipment is recognizable on many farms across the country.
We're known for our planters and grain carts.
Products easily spotted in large displays in front of Kinsey's manufacturing hub along Interstate 80 in Williamsburg, Iowa, where the company employs over 500 people, most of them working with one key component.
Steel's obviously the lifeblood of Kinsey, where our factory is essentially a weld house. We cut, burn, shape, form, paint steel.
Steel, which now costs more, result of a 25% tariff on the material imported from most countries.
When there's a tariff on steel, it cuts right to the core of our fundamental product construction.
President Donald Trump imposed the tariffs with the goal of boosting U.S. steel production and related employment. While there has been a modest benefit to the domestic steel industry, Dix says increased costs are negatively impacting companies like Kinsey.
And those tariffs take their effect on our cost structure, on our profitability for the family, through our employees and out to our dealers and on to the final customers.
Those customers are mostly U.S. farmers who use Kinsey's products to plant soybean seeds. Soybean exports are now subject to retaliatory tariffs, which have sunk prices and contributed to another year of overall declining income for U.S. farmers. Concerns Dix explained to U.S. Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa, who participated in a roundtable discussion at Kinsey, along with farmers and others in Iowa impacted by tariffs. Ernst says the personal stories she gathers from these meetings go a long way in helping Trump understand the impact on her constituents.
He has a very different negotiating style, so he wants to start with the worst possible scenario and negotiate his way to a good and fair deal.
But Dick says 1 year under tariffs has already taken a toll on Kinsey's operations.
We're not really that big, so when I say that this impact has been a seven-figure impact for us in the past year, that's a substantial amount of money.
An amount that so far hasn't been passed on to customers or employees. Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Williamsburg, Iowa.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. An independent U.S. watchdog group labeled 16 nations as countries of particular concern for engaging in systematic, ongoing, egregious violations of religious freedom. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom cited China as one of the worst violators, detaining between 800,000 and 2 million adult Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps and relegating some of their children to orphanages simply because of their religious identity. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more from the State Department.
When it comes to violating religious rights, Commissioner Gary Bauer tells VOA China is in a league of its own, most notably with its internment and torture of Uyghur Muslims.
But it's also against Tibetan Buddhists, against Falun Dong, against the house churches, and now even the licensed churches. And there's one theme in all of this, that anytime the Chinese government sees that one of their citizens might feel a loyalty to something other than the Chinese communist government, they're threatened by that and they do everything they can to try to stamp it out.
Bauer says the U.S. knows which Chinese officials are responsible for severe religious freedom violations, and it needs to name them and press Chinese leaders to immediately set Uyghurs and other Muslims free. The commission says conditions for religious freedom also deteriorated in Nigeria in 2018, with the Nigerian government at national and state levels tolerating violence and discrimination.
I think Nigeria is on the list for a number of different reasons, including the ways in which it has tolerated, right, the kind of violence by non-state actors.
Several of the commissioners pointed out that increasingly, houses of worship around the world are finding themselves the targets of deadly terrorist attacks. Democratic Congressman Jim McGovern agrees.
We saw the terrible tragedy that just recently happened in California, another attack on a synagogue. We see attacks against the Muslim population in the United States and around the world. We've seen Christian churches being a focus of attacks here in the United States. So when we talk about religious freedom, it's not just halfway around the world, it's halfway down the block.
McGovern and Republican members of Congress said protecting houses of worship and religious freedom around the world is one issue that Americans across the political spectrum can agree on. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Coming up, a dispute over potatoes some Indian farmers grow. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. A settlement on profitable potatoes and more auto trade with Japan. These are the topics on this weekend's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
PepsiCo has offered to settle with a group of Indian farmers it was suing for using its patented potatoes. The farmers were cultivating the FC5 potato variety, which is exclusively grown for PepsiCo's popular Lay's potato chips. Since the lawsuit began, farmer activists have been fighting back. Farmer Jigar Patel.
PepsiCo is saying that it is their potato, but how will the farmer get to know? We don't have any laboratory.
The company, which set up its first potato chips plant in India in 1989, supplies the same FC5 potato variety to a different group of farmers who, in turn, sell their produce back to the company at a fixed price. PepsiCo is now offering a similar deal to the Indian potato growers in the lawsuit. Anand Yannick is a lawyer for PepsiCo.
PepsiCo company.
PepsiCo, on its own, submitted orally to the court
that they would like to settle this issue in dispute with the farmers. Either farmers shall not use FC5 in the future, or they may enter into agreement with PepsiCo, purchase the seeds from them, and sell produce of the potatoes to them.
A lawyer for the farmers has asked for time to consider the offer, and the next court hearing is due June 12. U.S. President Donald Trump is pressing Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to have Japanese automakers produce more vehicles in the United States. Toyota, Japan's largest automaker, said last month it would exceed a 2017 pledge to invest $10 billion over 5 years, with a new commitment to reach nearly $13 billion over that period. At a campaign rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin on Saturday, Trump praised the new investments. Referring to Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Trump said,
he started by saying that he's putting $40 billion into the United States for new car factories. Toyota's coming in with $14 billion. Many, many companies are coming in.
President Donald Trump has been a longtime advocate of boosting the American car manufacturing industry. As the White House threatens to impose tariffs of up to 25% on imported vehicles, he has simultaneously been prodding Japanese automakers to add more jobs and factories in the United States. President Trump is taking a trip to Japan in late May to celebrate the new Emperor of Japan. He says it's possible the United States and Japan will reach a new bilateral trade deal by that time. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend. If you have U.S. currency that is burnt, drenched, or even shredded into pieces, the remains can be legally exchanged at the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing. The main condition for exchange is that more than 50% of the banknote should be identifiable as U.S. currency. Lisa Bokalitz talked with Treasury Department experts and learned more about their unusual work. Anna Rice narrates her story.
Dirty money, literally, is accepted here at the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing. So is the money that's in really bad shape.
Any money that's been somehow damaged to the extent where you can't determine the value, this is the only place in the world that will accept U.S. currency.
Bureau employees even try to piece together shredded banknotes.
Just try to find the identifiable parts, like the mouth, the nose, eyes.
Most of the money is damaged in fires and floods, say Bureau employees. In one case, an individual who didn't trust banks after the housing market crash withdrew $2 million and stored it in a garage.
The money stored in a bag, but water had creeped in the bag and the notes had solidified together when they went to retrieve it.
Then there is money damaged by pets. Bureau employees go to surprising lengths to save it.
Sometimes it's just if you leave $20 on the coffee table, the dog will come and chew it up. Sometimes
really?
The dog will actually eat it and the owner will wait a few days and then wait for the dog to process it out. We do require you to wash it off before you send it in to us.
Walsh has worked on money damaged in the 9/11 attacks, Hurricane Katrina, and wildfires in California. One of his strangest cases took place a few decades ago.
Back in the early 80s, there was a farmer that lost his wallet in a field, and he discovered that his cow had eaten his wallet. And we always encourage people to send the currency in its original packaging. That way they don't cause further damage. He had sent it in the cow's stomach, and then the people that were working at the time had to deal with that.
Since then, the guidelines to process claims have gotten more specific.
We usually get about 24,000 submissions a year, and we reimburse just north of $40 million.
Anyone can mail in damaged money or personally bring it to the Bureau. If the examiner can recover at least 51% of the banknote, it will be exchanged for a new one. The old, damaged currency is then taken out of circulation. For Lisa Bokalitz in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
During the early hours of this past January 21st, people in North and South America, as well as Western Europe, were able to enjoy the best view of a total lunar eclipse. Some observers were also treated to something quite rare, a meteorite striking the surface of the moon when the eclipse was starting to reach totality. The meteorite was seen as a tiny 0.28-second flash, which some say was bright enough to be seen with the naked eye. Two Spanish astronomers using the Moon Impacts Detection and Analysis System captured video footage of the impact. After analyzing the video, the scientists determined that the meteorite struck the moon at 61,000 kilometers an hour and left a crater between 10 to 15 meters across. They also calculated that the meteorite had a mass of about 45 kilograms and was 30 to 60 centimeters wide. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thanks for tuning in to VOA Asia Weekend. For Ira Melman and Jim Stevenson, I'm Ari Erfin in Washington, D.C. Have a wonderful weekend, and we hope to see you again next week.